We're really happy to have Nathan Engelhardt today as a remote speaker. So we're going to have this really fancy talk now. And she's from Princeton, and she's going to talk about bulk constraints from sub-region causality. Please.
Thank you for agreeing to this somewhat unusual format. I'm very happy to be able to talk about this and have you listen even remotely. So this talk is based on work in progress with Sebastian Fischetti. It's mostly done, so you can look forward to seeing this on the archive maybe end of the month or beginning of next month, hopefully. Now, I've called this bulk constraints from subregion causality. This is this will feature in this talk, and it will be a motivation. But really, this talk is about introducing a formalism for dealing with problems about extremal surfaces of any codimension in ADS CFT. And this subregion causality and bulk constraints from subregion causality, these are really just applications of that formalism, which and sometimes show or illustrate how useful this formalism can be. So I will begin by motivating this in terms of this idea that we often use in ADS CFT to try to understand quantum gravity, which is that we have these fundamental principles in quantum field theory. And thanks to ADS CFT, we know that those should translate into facts about quantum gravity with ADS boundary conditions. And of course, we are secretly hoping that the boundary conditions don't really matter. So if we can take these fundamental principles in quantum field theory and derive equally fundamental facts about quantum gravity with ADS boundary conditions, that we're really deriving facts about quantum gravity in broad general, at least within the models that we have ADS CFT for. Now, today's focus will be on a particular type of principle in quantum field theory, in particular causality. Now, there are many different ways of thinking about causality in quantum field theory and translating it into a statement about ADS CFT. And the particular focus today is going to be on boundary causality in the context of subregion-subregion duality. And I'll say a lot more about what I mean by subregion causality in this context and how we can derive implications of this boundary causality and subregion causality for the dual bulk theory. What can we learn about the dual bulk theory when these fundamental principles about the quantum field theory are true? Now, as I mentioned before, this is really an excuse to talk about this different type of formalism. So it's often very difficult to go from things that we understand about quantum field theory to things that we can understand in the bulk. This is kind of an inverse problem in many ways. And it can be very hard. Now, we've made a lot of progress, and I would say maybe we've answered all the easy questions. So, but there are still a lot of interesting questions that need to be answered, and they're getting harder and harder. And as we'll see, the invoking a different type of formalism, recasting this in this elliptic operator language, gives us a lot more bulk mileage out of the same things that we already knew about the CFT. So this formalism really gives a very powerful and really tractable way of translating statements about subregion-subregion duality to the bulk. And not just subregion-subregion duality, this is really something that applies to extremal surfaces in broad generality, including, say, maximum volume slices. So it's not just a statement about subregion-subregion duality. It also allows us to close some kind of embarrassing gaps about our knowledge regarding extremal surfaces, whether they exist, whether they are stable, and in the particular context of codimension one surfaces, some questions about minimality versus maximality. So with that in mind, I'm going to begin with just a reminder of subregion-subregion duality, what I mean by subregion-subregion duality, and normally mean that. So this is the formula that I think we've all seen at some point. The formula relating the von Neumann entropy of a boundary subregion in ADS CFT to the area of a surface X of R over 4G H bar. And I put the dots there to signify higher order corrections, 1 over N, or the string corrections, and so on. So here are two pictures. They're both cartoons of what's going on. So this is a situation on the left-hand side is where we have the time direction suppressed. This is the region R, and this is the surface X of R. And here we have the time direction is not suppressed. We have suppressed the spatial directions. This is the region R. This is the domain of dependence, the entanglement wedge. This is the HRT surface and the generators of the entanglement wedge. These are null vectors fired from this HRT surface. No, the HRG surface is a surface which is homologous to the region R, and it is a stationary point of the area functional. I will call it an extremal surface at some points in this talk, but that's really a misnomer, and it actually becomes important at some point in the talk that these are not really extremal surfaces. They're not extrema of the area functional. They are stationary points. And so this is the minimal area stationary surface, which is homologous to the boundary region R. Now, there is a proposal entangled with the subregion-subregion duality, the duality between the entanglement wedge and the region R, that the information in the domain of dependence of R is dual to the entanglement wedge. This was, I believe, initially proposed by Mark Van Remsdonk, but there have been a series of different proposals, refinements. And since then, it's been proven by Don Carlo and Wall in a particular case of quantum fields in a curved background, so within the curved subspace. Now, what do I mean by subregion-subregion causality? So there are multiple different things we can mean by that. I'm going to talk about two in particular. One is entanglement wedge nesting, which is the statement that if a region, if D of R is nested inside D of R prime, so you're looking at progressively larger boundary domains of dependence, then the corresponding entanglement wedges are nested as well. If you don't immediately see why this is a statement about causality, don't worry, I will dedicate a slide to explaining that. And the second one is causal wedge inclusion. It's a little easier to see why this one is a statement about causality. It's a statement that the causal wedge, which consists of all points that can simultaneously send signals to the boundary region D of R and receive signals from D of R, the statement that this region is a subset of the entanglement wedge. And this is clearly a statement about causality, because if this were not the case, then we would be able to send signals from the region V of R to the complementary entanglement wedge, which would allow us to, say, turn on some local operator and to use some local operators on one region to change the entanglement entropy of the other region. Now, in this upcoming paper, we will present the implications of both 1 and 2, again, using elliptic operator theory. But 1 is somewhat more interesting and is more instructive, so today I'm just going to talk about entanglement wedge nesting as a manifestation of subregion-subregion causality. So why is this a statement about subregion-subregion causality? Why does CFT causality imply entanglement wedge nesting? Well, let's consider a situation here where we have a region A and a region R, and every point in D of R is basically separated from every point in D of A. So in particular, D of R lies in a complement of D of A, it lies inside D of A complement. So operators that are localized to D of A commute with operators that are localized to a subset of D of A complement. This is a statement about causality or locality, whichever you choose to ascribe it to. So if the domain of dependence of R is a subset of the domain of dependence of A complement, as it is the way I've drawn it here, then the entanglement wedge of R is a subset of the entanglement wedge of A complement. And the domain of dependence of A is a subset of the domain of dependence of R complement. So this I haven't drawn here, but that would be DFR complement would be this something like this, and D of A clearly lives inside that. Now, because the HRT surface of R is the same as the HRT surface of R complement, this is true in the classical limit. It can be violated in the semi-classical limit, but for now, let's work in the classical limit. So in the classical limit, XR is equal to XR complement. So this means that the entanglement wedge of A lives inside the entanglement wedge of R complement whenever D of A lives inside D of R complement. So here we started with CFT causality, and we ended up with entanglement wedge nesting. In particular, a situation like this is something that we would like to exclude. This is forbidden by CFT causality. Okay, so here's a situation we like. This D of R complement is precisely meant to be this thing that I didn't draw here, so that would be R complement.
Can we ask a question?
Yeah. Yes.
I don't understand what the second picture is. It's a little hard to see. What are you indicating?
So the second picture is meant to be a situation where the two entanglement wedges are not separate away from one another.
They're hard to see, that's all.
Yeah, no worries. I know that the reds can sometimes display very poorly. That's something that I'll fix in the next iteration of this talk.
And there's one other question. You don't need any energy condition for this argument.
So far I haven't said anything about the bulk. I've just said that in order to conserve, and in order to have CFT causality, we need entanglement wedge nesting. So far I haven't used anything about the bulk other than it has a CFT dual, so no, not yet.
But you said CFT causality implies the entanglement wedge nesting, right?
That's right. So in a couple of slides, I'll talk about how we prove entanglement wedge nesting. And of course, all of the current proofs use the null energy condition to prove entanglement wedge nesting. So yes, I'll get to that. If you just give me wait a couple of slides and see if that resolves your question.
Okay. Yeah. So, since you're paused, you're saying this applies completely generally in the bulk. Like it doesn't have to be the vacuum. It can be any reasonable solution.
So what I'm saying is that as long as you have a classical bulk dual,
right?
So that a subregion-subregion duality is valid where the subregion in the bulk is defined by the entanglement wedge, which is bounded by a classical surface, which is a stationary point of the area functional, then the statement it has to be true in broad generality.
For a black hole, don't I run into situations where XR is not equal to XRC, or am I thinking about that wrong?
So that depends on what you mean by R complement. So so the union of R and R complement is the full CFT, which has to be in a pure state.
Okay.
As long as the bulk is, so if you have a two-sided black hole,
yeah.
R complement includes the second boundary.
Yeah, okay. Thank you.
If you have a semi-classical space-time and you have quantum fields in the bulk, then they can have an entanglement entropy and then your bulk state can be mixed and then it does not have to be true. Okay, so this is a desirable situation where we have here the nesting of the two entanglement wedges. Now, as was just pointed out, there's a proof for HRT surfaces by Aaron Wall from 2012, which assume the null energy condition and certain stability requirements. Actually, as it turns out, those stability requirements that didn't actually make sense, but recently there was a paper by Don Merrill that fixed that to a new stability requirement that actually makes it true. The proof does work now. And later on, Aaron and I also proved a similar version of this for extremal surfaces which are not necessarily minimal. And this assumes the null energy condition, and instead of stability, it assumes certain continuity conditions. So we call this extremal surface barriers. It's in some sense a version of entanglement wedge nesting with a different sort of orthogonal set of assumptions than what was proven for the HRT surfaces by Aaron in 2012. Okay, so what does entanglement wedge nesting imply? Now, sometimes I get funny looks when I ask this question because people will say, well, it implies entanglement wedge nesting. But that's not a very useful thing to work with because in order to tell whether a space-time satisfies entanglement wedge nesting, you have to check every possible boundary subregion and you have to check every possible surface. And so that's not a very useful criterion for whether a space-time has a CFT dual or not. And in particular, this is a valuable statement to ask, a valuable question to ask, because not all possible spacetimes are going to satisfy entanglement wedge nesting. So something valuable has to be extractable from entanglement wedge nesting. What I mean by something valuable is a statement about the curvatures, for example, something about the curvature invariant, about the stress tensor, something we can just check and see, does a spacetime have a CFT dual or does it not? So this is what I'm going to call geometric implications of entanglement wedge nesting. And in order to derive the geometric implications of entanglement wedge nesting, we need to be able to control the way that the HRT surfaces change under deformations of the boundary conditions. Now, this is actually pretty hard. The way we usually deal with problems involving extremal surfaces, if we want to prove something in broad generality, is using various causality arguments. We talk about tangency of null hypersurfaces at a point. There are various subtleties concerned with that, cusps and conjugate points, intersections, but in general, it's fairly straightforward what we need to do, what assumptions we need to make in order to have these statements be true. But now we're trying to do something in the reverse. We want to constrain the behavior of the space-time based on the behavior of extremal surfaces. And this is very, very difficult. None of our ordinary geometric arguments really work in order to do that. And that suggests that a different, maybe non-geometric method is needed in order to extract this information. So this is where I start the real part of the talk. I'm going to begin with the equation of extremal deviation, which is an equation that essentially tells you how an extremal surface behaves under modifications of its boundary conditions. And I'll talk about where elliptic operator theory comes in, and then use a couple of different theorems from elliptic operator theory just to illustrate how easy it is to get really nice results about the behavior of extremal surfaces if we just take results that have been proven by mathematicians and apply them to our setup, knowing that it's described by elliptic operators. I'll say a few words about stability and what I mean by that, what we call the sourced equation of extremal deviation. And as it turns out, this formalism is actually robust under quantum corrections. So it's fairly simple to include quantum corrections in extremal deviation. And then I'll conclude. So let's begin with geodesics, which themselves are extremal surfaces. And ask, you know, if we want to talk about the way that geodesics change, if we say modify their boundary conditions, we talk about the equation of geodesic deviation. So here we have a set of geodesics, and TA here, this is the tangent vector toward geodesic gamma, and eta A, this is what we call the deviation vector. And it's in many ways, in some sense, it measures how the two nearby geodesics move away or towards one another as you evolve along these geodesics. Now, the equation of geodesic deviation, it's usually written in this form, but you can simply rewrite it in this way, where this is just the derivative, the second directional derivative along gamma. This is the induced metric on gamma, and this here is the Riemann tensor, and eta is the deviation vector. So if this is the way that geodesics behave, how nearby geodesics deviate from one another, then it stands to reason we should be able to do something similar for higher dimensional analogs of geodesics, that we should be able to write some equation that tells us what happens to them as we modify the boundary conditions. So the expectation is perhaps something like this, where now we've replaced this with the Laplacian, with the Laplace-Petrami operator on X. X is our, say, extremal surface, and H here is the induced metric on it as before. This is generally the right idea, but it turns out that the higher dimensional extremal surfaces actually have non-zero extrinsic curvature. Geodesics, of course, are one-dimensional. So if they have vanishing trace of the extrinsic curvature, they have vanishing extrinsic curvature. But these extremal surfaces can have non-vanishing extrinsic curvature, and there are terms that contribute to the equation as a result. And what we get instead is this equation over here. So here we have, this is very similar to that, but it differs in this additional tensor over here, and as well as this projection operator. So this projection projects onto the directions that are normal to our extremal surface. You can check this is actually trivial for a geodesic. So you can put this projection in front of the geodesic equation, geodesic deviation equation, but it doesn't actually do anything. And this tensor here, this contains information about the extrinsic curvature of X. I'm not gonna bother writing it down. It's called the Simons tensor. It's just a combination of extrinsic curvatures. So this is the equation that effectively tells us exactly how these extremal surfaces behave under deformations of, say, the boundary conditions, where those are given by the behavior of eta, the deviation vector, at the boundary. So we can rewrite this.
Can I ask a question real quick? That Laplacian, is it like a covariant Laplacian acting on the normal vector, or should I think of this as just like a component? A Laplacian acting on the component of the scalar. Does that make sense?
So sorry, the last thing you said. It's a covariant Laplacian. It's a Laplace-Petrami operator. Covariant Laplacian.
On a normal vector, though.
On a normal vector. So this is projected onto the surface, but it is a Laplacian defined in the full space time.
It's space time Laplacian. Basically, I'm asking, do you need a connection on the normal bundle to define that Laplacian, and it's in the Laplacian, or is it the scalar Laplacian on a component of the normal?
So, you do need a connection on the normal bundle.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm trying not to get into the super, super technical details here, but yeah, that is
correct. Yeah. Okay.
So this can be rewritten as an operator equation. So here we have an operator L acting on the vector eta, and this is an operator equation, which is equal to zero. And again, if we're talking about surfaces with codimension higher than one, then this is an operator, a vector equation. Whereas if we're talking about surfaces, about say codimension one surfaces, this is just a scalar equation. So effectively what this tells you, this is a vector equation for an extremal surface X prime. So here I've drawn it. And given an extremal surface X, where eta here is the normal to X, so you really the correct way to think about it is eta is along a family of deformations from X to X prime, and that's what parametrizes the deformation. So it yields a deformation that goes from X to X prime. And again, if you're thinking of this in terms of modifying boundary conditions, you think of setting the value of eta at infinity, or fixing eta at infinity, and then solving for X prime, or really solving for eta everywhere else, which gives you X prime. So here is I've drawn the ADS boundary, and we get from X to X prime using this deviation vector eta. Okay, so this really is what we call an elliptic operator problem. So L and its components in any basis are actually elliptic second order operators whenever the surfaces in question are space-like. And I'll say a couple of words about what happens when they're time-like. Now, a lot is known about elliptic operators. They have many very nice properties that have been studied in mathematics, and we can use all of those to study surfaces with vanishing mean curvature, these stationary surfaces that we are interested in any codimension. So this also works for geodesics. This also works for maximum volume slices. There is a caveat that will apply for the rest of the talk, so I'll just state it once, which is that extremal deviation equation can't describe the global properties and changes in extremal surfaces. So in particular, the HRT prescription requires us to find all of the stationary points of the area functional and then take the minimal one. If there is a jump in the along the deformation because the minimal surface now lives somewhere finitely away, this formalism can't actually accommodate that. So it's going to only look at what's going to be the local minimum. So we need to stay away from situations where we just exactly have a phase transition in order for these results to tell us about HRT surfaces. Now, this is an aside about the timeline case. So it turns out that extremal deviation was actually discovered independently in the context of string world sheets and brains. Those are also extremal surfaces. And these are described by hyperbolic operators. Not as much is known about hyperbolic operators. So I'm actually going to be sticking to elliptic operators in particular because my interest lies more in these space-like surfaces. But it's worth noting that this isn't the first time that we found that recasting a problem about extremization in geometry in terms of this algebraic language is very helpful. Okay, so insights from elliptic operator theory. So here we have the statement of entanglement wedge nesting. So the vector L of eta is equal to zero. So right now I'm talking specifically about codimension two surfaces for the moment. So this is really the statement that there exists an extremal surface near X in the direction eta A. Now entanglement wedge nesting is the statement that if eta is space-like near the boundary, so the vector from D of A to D of R is space-like near the boundary, then it's space-like everywhere. So this is a statement that guarantees entanglement wedge nesting. Another way of saying this is that if we expand eta A in the basis of the generators of the entanglement wedge, so K is one generator and L is the path directed generator, then we can expand eta in this way, alpha KA plus beta LA. And this statement is then that if alpha beta is greater than zero asymptotically, then it's greater than zero ever. So they have to have the same sign. In particular, if alpha and beta are both greater than zero, you're going outwards. If alpha and beta are both less than zero, you're going inwards. Okay, so now we get to use some fun elliptic operator stuff. I'm going to go back and forth between maximum and minimum principle because they're really the same thing. So let's recall some one variable calculus. Now we have here we have an inequality, and we ask, okay, what can we learn about this inequality? Well, the maximum principle, in this case, the minimum principle really, is that the function u cannot attain a non-positive local minimum. So if u is greater than or equal to zero at the boundary of the domain, then you could show that u is greater than or equal to zero everywhere. Now, this statement carries over to scalar elliptic operators in general, and also to certain types of vector elliptic operators, which for those who thrive on terminology are called cooperative elliptic operators. And part of the point of this talk is that you don't have to, you won't have to learn all of these terms and go through all the pain that Sebastian and I had to go through. But in case you wanted to look this up, they're called cooperative elliptic operators. So let's talk about these maximum minimum principles for elliptic systems. So for codimension less than or equal to 2, and we actually cannot really do this for different codimensions other than 1 and 2. But for codimensions less than or equal to 2, then we can actually guarantee that L of eta is a scalar, a single scalar equation, or if the null energy condition is satisfied, it is a cooperative elliptic system. So let me parse that. What I mean by that is if we have codimension 1 surface, then L of eta is always going to be just a scalar equation. And actually, that is going to mean that it always has a maximum or minimum principal property. When the null energy condition is satisfied, it is also possible to do this for codimension 2 surfaces, because in that case, you can prove that there are these special cooperative elliptic systems. So in either case, the maximum minimum principle applies always for codimension 1 surfaces, and when the null energy condition is satisfied, also for codimension 2 surfaces. So this actually gives us a proof of continuous entanglement wedge nesting in one line. So the maximum principle, minimum principle, tells us that if the null energy condition is satisfied and alpha is greater than 0 and beta is greater than 0 at the asymptotic boundary, then alpha is greater than 0 and beta is greater than 0 everywhere on XA. This is simply the exact application of the maximum principle. And this is exactly entanglement wedge nesting. So in particular, the assumption you have to make about this is very minimal compared to the assumptions that Aaron Wall and I had to make for extremal surface barriers, or what Aaron had to make for to prove the null energy, to prove the entanglement wedge nesting for this maxi-min surfaces. So there's no, the stability requirement that goes into this is so minimal, it doesn't even really bear writing down. So this is a relaxed version, and it is extremely simple to prove, which really illustrates the power of this this type of formalism. So now, of course, we didn't construct this all of this. We didn't write down all this formalism and develop it just in order to be able to reprove things that we already knew, no matter how elegant the new proof is. We'd like to be able to derive things about the bulk, new things. Now, it's a little complicated because without the null energy condition, for a codimension 2 surface, the system is not cooperative. At least we can't prove that it is. So what we can do, however, is we can decompose our operator into two scalar operators.
Sorry,
was that a question?
Yeah, could you? Yeah. I was just wondering if you could say a little bit more about where this cooperative, like what, how do you see if it's cooperative? Because you have something that's like Laplacian plus some sort of potential. And I guess it's something about the potential that lets you say.
Yeah, so it's about, it has to do with the sign of certain eigenvalues of the Simons tensor. So you have to, so you look at the zero order term, the Simons tensor plus the Riemann tensor.
Yeah.
And the fact that it's cooperative is a statement about positivity of this in a certain basis. So in a null basis, it's possible to rewrite all of that so that you only have terms like the shear squared, the TKK, and so the combinations are such that if you have a null basis of the normal bundle, then you can show that the terms are always going to be positive, which guarantees for you it's a cooperative system. Now, what happens if you have, say, a codimension 3 surface is you can't write it in that basis any longer. So it becomes a lot more difficult to prove that it's a cooperative system. And in particular, you might have to make assumptions about some weird, maybe space-like energy conditions in order to guarantee that, because now your normal bundle has these three directions. And I guess depending on the signature of the surface, those might be two space-like ones and one null, for instance.
Yeah,
so I don't know if this,
I was sort of,
does that answer your
question? It seems like, I'm surprised that it's just the null energy condition, because it seems like once you're at codimension 2 or higher, you have a Weyl tensor that also shows up in the equation.
This is true, but it turns out that it shows up in a way that doesn't foil any of the conditions you need for the cooperative property.
In any codimension or just 2?
No, just for codimension 2.
Okay.
It's special. Codimension 2 is special.
Okay.
Yeah, higher than codimension 2, we don't know how to prove what you need to assume in order to prove that it's cooperative.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Okay, so if we're working with a codimension 2 surface, then L has two components for the two normal directions to the surface. And we can expand it in a basis. So K here is a null vector, and V is any other vector normal to X, which we will always take to be space-like, because we can, and it's simpler that way. Now, after we rearrange the operator the way that I wrote it before, we get two scalar equations for extremal deviation. They're coupled equations. And so here is one of them. So this is just the one in the V direction, and we can write another one which has the contributions from RLL instead of RKK. Now, entanglement wedge nesting is now the statement that any solution to this equation which has psi greater than or equal to zero asymptotically has psi greater than zero everywhere. Now, because scalar operators always have a maximum or minimum principle that we can apply to them, if we're careful with how they're coupled, then we can still apply the maximum minimum principle, even if we don't necessarily know that the system satisfies the null energy condition. Now, and so by writing it in this way, we can actually get a new result pretty much immediately from the maximum principle. And this result sounds a little bit like a quantum energy inequality. So entanglement wedge nesting, we find, implies that TKK plus sigma K squared, and sigma K squared here is the shear in the K direction, it can't be non-positive everywhere on an HRT surface unless it is strictly zero everywhere. So in particular, you can't have a situation where TKK plus sigma K squared is zero everywhere on the surface, and there's some small localized pocket of negative energy somewhere on the surface without a pocket of positive energy somewhere else to make up for it. So for example, if we have an arbitrarily small perturbation, classical perturbation of pure ADS, which has TKK equal to zero, and this small perturbation has TKK less than zero somewhere, then it had better have TKK greater than zero somewhere else. This is for regions without shear where we get the tightest bound. And so this looks a lot like a quantum energy inequality. You can't localize the negative energy arbitrarily far from positive energy. This isn't the most quantitative statement, but it is a new statement and an interesting one in that it tells us something about how we can localize TKK on an HRT surface for perturbations of, say, something like pure ADS. Now, the fact that these perturbations are maybe the easiest way to try to understand this statement suggests that perhaps we should look at perturbations of spacetimes with TKK equal to zero to get something more quantitative and something like pure ADS. And indeed, a careful analysis of the equation of extremal deviation around pure ADS gives us a derivation of a positive energy theorem. Now, this positive energy theorem was actually first established by a different group of people in a very different context. So this is the statement that if you integrate over the extremal surface, the delta TKK, where delta TKK is a perturbation of the stress energy tensor due to perturbation of the spacetime, so sourced by some perturbation of the spacetime, then this has to be greater than zero. So this derivation, again, is quite simple, and it follows in a very nice way. Combination of maximum principles and the fact that a lot of things simplify in pure ADS. And again, this is a result that was known before, unlike the previous result about the quantum energy inequality, but it's a much simpler way of deriving that result, which is much easier to derive if only we knew this before. Okay, so now I want to move on to showcasing a couple of the results that have not been established before in any context. And this is about stability of extremal surfaces. And this is where it's actually going to be important, the distinction between stationary and extremal. So I'm going to give you a small anecdote. So last summer, I gave a talk at a math conference. And I started talking about the HRT surfaces and the nice set of results. And the first question I was asked, was maybe a few minutes into the talk, was, how do you know extremal surfaces exist in general? And this was quickly followed by, how do you know that when they exist, they are stable? And I'm pretty sure they meant stable against perturbation. And so I think my expression looked roughly something like this. And I sort of waved my hands and did some arm flailing, hand waving, and said, oh, you know, we're physicists. We don't really worry about such mundane topics as existence and stability. But then I started worrying about it. So how can we figure this out? How can we guarantee for ourselves that extremal surfaces exist and In particular, they are stable under perturbations of the space-time. So if an extremal surface XR exists in a given space-time, how can we be sure it doesn't disappear under a small perturbation to that geometry? And if you're wondering why we care about this, well, there's a sense in which some of the proofs of HRT, the arguments for HRT, RT and HRT, use the fact that you can perturb the space-time and the surface will still be there. So for this, we developed a new equation, which is called the source, we call this the source to extremal deviation equation. So here we have our old friend L, same operator as before, but now there's a source term here. And this source term is basically is coming from the fact that the space-time is being perturbed. A stability of an extremal surface, or really here I mean a stationary surface, under small perturbations of G, is the statement that this equation has a solution for any delta G. So what we'd like to guarantee, we'd like to just find some criterion that promises us that this equation has a solution. And this is when we can whip out a different result from electric operator theory called the Fredholm alternative. And I should say this only applies for codimension one or two surfaces. So let L be an elliptic operator, then it's exactly one of the two conditions is true. Either the homogeneous equation, L eta equals zero, with eta equals zero, has non-trivial solutions, meaning that our extremal surface, our original stationary surface, the HRT surface, is degenerate in the sense that there are surfaces that are anchored to the same boundary region that are also stationary and are arbitrarily close to our HRT surface. Or the sourced equation, L eta equals F, has a unique non-trivial solution for any F, where eta here is not necessarily zero at the bottom. So this is an alternative, which means that if we want two to be true, then one has to be false. There's the statement that an extremal surface XR is stable under perturbations if and only if XR is locally unique. So it is locally there's only one surface which solves these extremality equations, only one surface which is stationary and anchored to this boundary region. We don't care about another surface which solves it somewhere finitely separated from our original one. But the surface itself has to be locally unique. Another way of saying this is that the surface is stable if and only if the spectrum of L contains no zero eigenvector. So this gives us a nice characterization. For example, we can simply look at the operator L, and if we can diagonalize it, we can check to see if it has a zero eigenvalue. And you know, if it doesn't, then we say we're good. We know that the surface is stable. There's also a different notion of stability, which perhaps is, to some of us at least, more intuitive. And in order to talk about it, I'm going to have to complain for a little bit, so please indulge me. Extremal surfaces in the HRT prescription, as I mentioned, aren't actually extrema of the area. They are stationary points, but they're not extrema. So the distinction is actually important, and this is because there is a different notion of stability for surfaces that are actually extremal, like some, like say maximal volume slices, which are actual maxima. And that notion doesn't make sense for HRT surfaces because they are not neither maxima nor min. So what do we mean by stability for actually extremal surfaces? Let's consider an example of a great circle on a sphere going from say pole to pole, and it's a minimal surface between north and south poles. But if you extend it beyond the South Pole, there are small variations of it that cause the length to decrease. Now, this is simply the phenomenon of conjugate points at the poles. So we can extend this type of statement to higher dimensional surfaces, which are actual extrema, by studying the variations, the second variations of the area functional. So in other words, we'd like to ask if under second variation of the area functional, does the area decrease or does it increase? And this gives us a notion of stability for actually extremal surfaces. Now, the details of how we do this are fairly technical, and you have to develop a whole theory of how to talk about these non-local functionals on surfaces, like the integral of the area element. But there's actually one nice unifying principle. So again, that L be a deviation operator on a surface X. And we say L is stationary stable. So here we're thinking about stationary surfaces. If the spectrum of L has no zero eigenvalue, so this means X is stable under space-time perturbations. We say L is extremal stable, so this is stable for something like a minimal surface or a maximal surface, if the spectrum of L is bounded from below by zero. So this means that the second variation of the area or volume of X has definite sign. And this can be thought of as actually the higher dimensional generalization of X having no conjugate points for higher dimensional surfaces. So this is stability for, say, a maximal volume slice, as opposed to stability for an HRT surface, which in this context doesn't really make sense. So we are able to just look at, say, the smallest eigenvalue of the operator L, and immediately we can tell, is our surface stable or is it not? So this concludes the aside on the source equation of extremal deviation and this stability criteria, which were not known before, but really, we really need those because we don't ever want to be dealing with extremal surfaces that are not stable. Now, I promised at the beginning that this formalism is it's robust under quantum corrections. So now I'm going to talk a little bit about quantum extremal deviation. So in order to do this, we need to talk about quantum extremal surfaces. So the leading order in N and lambda, the quantum entropy of the boundary theory is given by the HRT surface XR, which again is a stationary point of the area. And quantum entropy is the area of the surface. So again, just to leading order, it's just the area of XR. Now, once we sorry, is there a question?
No.
Okay. Once we add quantum corrections, so here it's just an instance where I've added quantum corrections in a diagram, then we actually get a contribution from the bulk entanglement to the von Neumann entropy of the boundary theory. This was shown by Ochner-Lukowitz and Maldesane. Now, if you want to go to even higher orders, or higher subleading orders in 1 over n, the surface itself has to change. So is the surface computing the von Neumann entropy is no longer a stationary point of the area functional. It's actually a stationary point of the area plus the bulk entanglement. So now we extremize this quantity. And to distinguish between the two surfaces, I'll call the quantum surface chi and the original classical surface x. So chi here is a stationary point of the area plus the bulk. Okay, so now I'm going to a lot of very painful derivation and just give you the quantum equation of the equation of quantum extremal deviation. So here, this is the classical component, and the quantum piece, the quantum correction that we get, is this integral over the surface of this functional derivative, second functional derivative of the quantity S out. And this is a functional derivative with respect of the extremal surface of the surface XR. So R here, so P prime here just points on the surface, and this is integrated again volume element of the surface. So we picked up this quantum correction here, and this tells us how a family of quantum extremal surfaces performs under modifications to the boundary conditions. Now in a classical regime, we got an integrated null energy condition from entanglement wedge nesting. So what are we going to get in the semi-classical? We don't need the null energy condition for quantum entanglement wedge nesting to hold. And so we don't expect to get anything but the integrated null energy condition. So what are we going to get? And what we would like to get is something relating to quantum focusing, because that's what replaces the null energy condition in proofs of entanglement wedge nesting. So what do I mean by quantum focusing? What is quantum focusing and why should you care? Well, just as a brief aside here, pillars of GR, you know, things like singularity theorems, good causal spectrum, gravitational thermodynamics, all of these rely on focusing of light rays. And focusing requires the null energy condition. This is how we prove entanglement wedge nesting in the first place. Of course, the null energy condition is easily violated in quantum field theory. Now, nonetheless, we do know that GR is a really good effective description of the universe. So we would expect that the pillars of GR should be robust against quantum corrections. Otherwise, we're in pretty bad shape. So we expect that there are quantum corrected versions of all of these results that don't rely on the null energy condition, but on something that's some quantum corrected focusing. So this was proposed by Guzzo, Fischer, Leichenauer, and Wall. It's a statement that basically corrects focusing so that the quantum corrected analogies of the singularity theorems, of causal structure theorems, gravitational thermodynamics are still valid. And in fact, historically, this worked the other way. First, the gravitational thermodynamics was quantum corrected, causal structure theorems were quantum corrected, singularity theorems were quantum corrected, and eventually, these four folks realized that, well, you should be thinking about quantum focusing as guaranteeing all of these. Also, this implies the by now notorious quantum null energy condition in the non-gravitational limit. It's also an unproven conjecture. It's been proven in various limiting regimes, but it doesn't have a broad proof. So if internal image nesting in a classical regime gives us a smeared null energy condition, can it give us a smeared quantum focusing conjecture in the quantum regime? And the answer is yes, but before I do that, I want to just write down what we mean by quantum focusing in a slightly more precise way than it's quantum corrected focusing. So here's just a chart comparing classical and quantum quantities. So here we have the area of a 4GH bar. This turns into the generalized entropy, area of a 4GH bar plus quantum plus entanglement corrections. The classical expansion, which is the proportional to the rate of change of the area, as along these null the null generators, lambda here is an affine parameter, becomes a functional derivative of the generalized entropy. These are null variations of a surface of a slice. Finally, we have classical focusing. This is d theta d lambda less than zero, and here we have quantum focusing, which is the functional derivative of this quantum expansion. So this is roughly speaking how we're going to go back and forth from one to the other. Effectively, wherever you see area, you put in generalized entropy. And of course, there is the subtlety that the fact that the generalized entropy is a non-local quantity means you have to take functional derivatives rather than ordinary. Okay, so how do we go from quantum entanglement ring nesting to quantum focusing? Well, if the quantum extremal surface extremizes or is a stationary point of the generalized entropy, then at least small variations of the location of it do not change the generalized entropy. Or equivalently, the quantum expansion of this quantum extremal surface is zero. And this is how we can make contact with the quantum focusing conjecture by entanglement wedge nesting. The statement about the quantum expansion that we can work with. Now, whenever classical focusing is strictly satisfied, quantum corrections can't possibly result in violations. So in order to test the quantum focusing conjecture in a non-trivial way, we need a situation where classical focusing is satisfied marginally. So d theta d lambda is actually zero, that we might have to worry that quantum corrections could cause it to become positive. So a situation like this is the vacuum in pure ADS, where all of the quantum extremal surfaces lie on a null-killing horizon. So in fact, we do get a smeared quantum focusing conjecture from entanglement wedge nesting. And the details are pretty painful, so I didn't put them in the talk. And this is really written in schematic notation only. But what we get is a smeared version of the statement that this quantity is less than or equal to zero. So here, this is integrated over the quantum extremal surface. And this is for perturbations of vacuum ADS due to quantum back reaction. You can think of this as a proof of the quantum focusing conjecture to second subleading order because we are including quantum back reaction. And this in particular makes no assumptions about the equations of motion. Now, if you wanted to assume that the back reaction of quantum fields is described by a semi-classical Einstein equation, what you could do is you could take the proof of the QNAP for free fields propagating along a killing horizon, and you could use the semi-classical Einstein equation to prove actually this exact statement as well. However, I would say that it's a little bit questionable whether we don't have too much evidence in favor of the semi-classical Einstein equation actually being the correct way to back react quantum fields on a geometry. So the fact that this doesn't make use of a particular form of the equations of motion is very valuable. Now I should say a word or two about what F here is. So F is a known smearing function. I didn't want to write it down. It's not super complicated, but it's a known function. It is just finite at the boundary. So when we can formally compactify. So what this means is that this integral is not dominated by asymptotics. You might worry that if this blows up as we reach the asymptotic boundary, that this integral is dominated by what happens asymptotically and doesn't actually probe any deep open. But this is not what happens. This thing remains finite as you go to the boundary, so it actually receives genuine deep bulk contributions and is telling us about the quantum focusing conjecture deep in the bulk, again, without assuming any particular form of the equations of motion. Okay, so let me now move on towards the end. So I would say we've more or less solved all the problems about HRT surfaces that are easy to solve geometrically. And as I said in the beginning, there's a lot of important physics that we haven't accessed yet because it hasn't been easy to solve those problems geometrically. Now, reformulating problems about extremal surfaces in terms of elliptic operator theory gives us a lot of tools. It gives a whole new toolbox for answering all these problems that are very hard to address geometrically. Just like if you look at the proofs of entanglement wedge nesting from the null energy condition, not only are they complicated, but they're also fraught with all kinds of subtleties that are difficult to address properly. Like the situation where what if the tangency argument you're applying really takes two null hypersurfaces where one of them has a cusp, and you can't really talk about tangency anymore. These are issues that don't come up when you're doing this in terms of elliptic operators. Now, we can prove entanglement wedge nesting, as I said. We can also prove a global statement, this quantum energy inequality about generic spacetime in a very simple way from the minimum principle. And we can derive this positive energy result without having to work too hard. We can address questions about existence of extremal surfaces and validity of HRT, about the stability, and not just HRT surfaces. We have this, have a nice formulation of this additional type of stability that's specifically for surfaces that are actual extrema. And it's simply a statement about the spectrum of an operator, bounded from below. You can just check what the lowest eigenvalue is. And the formalism is very well suited to accommodate quantum corrections. We have this equation of quantum extremal deviation. We can give the first proof of this mirrored quantum focusing conjecture that includes back reaction and doesn't assume anything about the equations of motion other than they are satisfied. Some upcoming things and things we have to do. So math literature is hard to decipher. I'll admit this, that a large part of this project has been dedicated to trying to understand what the mathematicians are trying to tell us. But you don't have to worry about that, because the upcoming paper with Sebastian, logical introduction to all of this and all of these results will be explained in a self-contained way. Now, there are many theorems and results that haven't been used yet. There are generalizations of the maximum non-cooperative systems. There are things that are neither the maximum principle nor the primitive. Those can probably be used to prove a lot of interesting things, maybe analogs of this integrated positive energy theorem for spacetimes that are not perturbations of ADS. Who knows? There's really a lot of information out there, whole wall in the Princeton library at least, that we haven't gotten to delve into. Now, this could potentially, in principle, be used to generalize the results of Faulkner, Mark von Ramstein, and others on the Einstein equation to include quantum corrections. So they derived the Einstein equation to second order. And in principle, these results could potentially be used to do this, including quantum corrections. So we would actually be able to tell if the semi-classical Einstein equation is really actually valid to for valid equation for back reaction. The scope, I would say, is really only limited by creativity and applying new results about elliptic operator theory. So as an example, elliptic operator theory was used in Mann-Ehrens DFT dual of the apparent horizon, which was a couple years ago now. And we didn't even realize it at the time. We really sat down to figure out what was really going on, and we realized this is all has been resolved using elliptic operator theory. So I think this has a lot of potential, and really we can learn a lot about physics and a lot about the bulk if we are just able to use all of these rules in a nice way. So thank you very much for your attention.
Can I ask you about something that's I've always wondered about the quantum focusing and proving it? I always thought that if you proved quantum focusing, that would contain a higher curvature second law proof as well. So I was wondering, just because you could take a limit where you get the higher curvature.
Sorry, can you speak up a little bit?
So the quantum focusing, if you were to have a full proof, I would have thought there's a limit of, you could take a limit where basically the quantum parts of the entropy don't matter, and you instead get a higher curvature second law as a consequence. Is there anything like that? Like, but you didn't say anything about higher curvature correction, so I'm wondering.
We didn't say anything about higher curvature. This is true. I guess we simply haven't looked into it to see if there's anything that changes in any way. So I don't know. What you're saying makes a lot of sense, but I'm hesitant to confirm and say absolutely that's the way it would work without having looked into it.
But I guess you can just ignore them because you assume that subleading divergences in the entropy kind of aren't dominating, I guess.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I will try to arrange another seminar for Nata, so you'll get a chance to ask for questions. I mean, you're a bit.
Sorry, was there another question?
I think Zach was talking about it, right? We'll try to arrange you another seminar like this in a few weeks if you want. Oh, was not determined, maybe.
You're asking you to do another seminar.
Yes.
Just do all of our seminars?
Exactly.
We're saying it's practice teaching. We could offer to give, we could teach a mini course on what the operator is.
That'd be nice.
Wait, could I ask maybe just one more conceptual question?
No, yeah, sure.
What does a violation of entanglement wedge nesting look like? Like, is there an example?
Well, what is what? Sorry.
Like, say entanglement wedge nesting doesn't always hold. What does it look like when it's violated? I have trouble imagining what it looks like.
So my favorite example of a situation where entanglement wedge nesting is violated is if you have a big rip singularity. And what ends up happening is that instead of moving in a space-like direction, you imagine you have your, can you see me, or is it too small? Can you see me?
Yes.
Okay. So if you take your boundary region and you shrink it in a space-like, in a space-like way, then your HRT surface, instead of moving in a space-like direction, it moves in a time-like direction. So you don't have nesting. I mean, I think there are two different ways you could violate entanglement wedge nesting. You could either violate it in a space-like direction, where as you shrink the boundary in, maybe your HRT surface sort of weaves in and out. Or you could violate it in a time-like direction, which is in some sense more intuitive, where it's simply by shrinking the region, your HRT surface moves not quite in a space-like or null direction, but actually moves slightly towards the future. So and this is, I believe, what happens if you have a big rip singularity, which very, very badly violates the null energy condition in the bulk.
So have people written down explicit violations? I just feel like it would conceptually be a nice thing to look at to see what goes wrong.
So I think there is a paper by Matt Hedrick where he talks about violations of strong subadditivity due to violations of the null energy condition. And if I recall correctly, I think he also talks about violations. I think it's clear that there should be also violations of entanglement wedge nesting in that situation, I think.
Okay.
This is, I think, Matt Hedrick and Rob Callan and a third author, I don't remember who.
Maybe we just thank Natalia.